Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors. Welcome to the PI World interview on Thursday, 10th September 2020. I'm your host, Tamsin Freeman, and today I'm delighted to be joined by Castleford Tiger, who many of you will know for his ADVFN musings on different stocks, especially Dart, and for which he was cited by Andy Brough in our recent PI World interview. Andrew, thanks so much for joining me. Can you tell us a little bit about your career background and how you got into investing?
Yes, of course I can. Good afternoon, everyone, from a very sunny and bright Yorkshire. So I came into the into a family business, which was a food distribution business in the late 70s. I was brought into the business by my father, and to look after the financial aspects of the business then, which was a reasonable size. We had 25 retail sites and a fairly big distribution business. I learned from a very early age that, first of all, from a financial background, I needed to be up to speed with the financial acumen and the business knowledge that the accountants and the advisors were discussing these issues with the board of directors. So I spent quite a long time getting up to speed with the accounts package that we were using, but more importantly, to be able to understand the financial implications of running a retail business, which at that time in the 70s was pre-supermarkets and was very strong and very, very busy. So from an early age, that was my background, but I was also involved in dealing with a number of suppliers, both overseas and within the UK. So I learnt from a very early stage that you never really wanted to be in a position where you were a forced seller of anything, of any asset, of any goods. And that really stuck with me. And, you know, never has it been more true than what we saw in late February and early March this year, where people who were forced sellers were selling stocks at the low point in the market. You know, the market fell from 7,500 down to 5,200 very quickly. And if you were in a position where you were overexposed, you were a forced seller. And anybody who could actually ride that storm, most of those losses have now come back. So that was something I learned very early in my business career, never to be in a position where you were a forced seller of any asset. So my education was specifically in accountancy and economics. And as part of that, I did a course on investing where we were given, and I can't remember whether the figure was 10,000 or 100,000 pounds in a virtual portfolio. And we had to invest that over a 6-month period. Now, things were very different then because the information streams were much slower. But anyway, I got hooked on this and learned an awful lot about it. I knew quite a few people who were stockbrokers or analysts, people who'd gone on from college or university and school into that sort of thing. And I worked with them, and you know, I really did. Had I not gone into the business, then perhaps that's the route I would have liked to have gone. But running the business allowed me to give some time, both at work and in my leisure time, over to investing and doing some analysis into companies. So that's basically how I got into investing, and that would probably be 1980. And one of my early successes was a company called Black's Leisure, which was the old equivalent of, I guess, Sports Direct now, who were taken over several times and buying companies, and then they fell on hard times. But they were one of the first ones that I became hooked on, and it was a great company. As I say, I made quite a lot of money out of that. So I guess that's where it started. So that's 40 years ago. So it's and fair what, while.
What sort of annual return are you looking to achieve from your investments?
Well, I never set myself a target, but it's a guess. I guess it's a bit like, you know, if I buy a property, I was always looking for a 10% return during or in this 40-year period. Obviously, inflation's been much higher than it is now. But I wouldn't really want to be looking for anything less than sort of 10% on an investment that was a dividend stock, which would be a 5 or 6% dividend yield and a 4 or 5% capital growth. Of course, that could be a little bit lumpy. It might not come in 12 months, but over a period of 2 or 3 years. But the stocks I'm generally interested in, which are the smaller caps, I've been averaging sort of 30 to 40% per annum across my portfolio for a number of years. Of course, you do get a bad year, but likewise, you get very, very good years. So, I think I'm averaging sort of 30 to 40%. Over the last few years.
And in the companies that you select to invest in, what criteria are you looking for?
I'm looking for anything that can cause a re-rating in a particular company. So I would start, if I'm looking at my growth companies, I would start by doing some due diligence on a particular company, having a look at what the company's about. And if we just quickly want to flip onto let's say Dart Group, Jet2 to be soon to be renamed. You know, when I first picked up on that, I picked up on it for a couple of reasons. Number one was that it was based in the north, it was based in Leeds. So it was very accessible for me. Jet2 Holidays was started only 10 years ago, and Jet2 Holidays were a completely different model to the market leader then, which was Thomas Cook, in that they weren't stuck to the 7 or 14 day traditional holiday period. They offered them for any number of days between 1 and 21 or 1 and 28, whatever it was. So that was a material change, and I think that excited people, and that got people interested in holidays. Not everybody wanted to go Saturday to Saturday. Some people wanted to go out on a Saturday, back on a Tuesday or a Wednesday. And Jet2 were the first to introduce that. And from zero in 2010, when this was launched, to 4 million holidays in 2019. With a growth rate most years of 100%, you know, 200,000 in the first year, 400,000, then to 800,000, then to 1.5 million. It was phenomenal. So I'm looking for companies that are going through change. And that change can be one of many things. It can be a change in strategy. It can be a change in management. Direction, or a material change in what the company does, and again, some of the companies that we'll discuss fall into that category.
And how long do you hold positions for? So, with COVID-19, have you traded in and out of anything, or what's your prompt to sell something?
Well, that's always a difficult one because when I buy a company, I'm not a day trader. I don't have the time to go long or go short on these. I actually buy the shares and I sit on those shares and I add to my position until such time that I feel that the market has woken to the fact of what this company is doing. And, you know, the Dart shares, Jet2, was 16p when I held just under 3% of the company, which today, had I maintained that position, would have been worth about 80 billion. Unfortunately, I sold an awful lot of those. But it's difficult to set a target, but I have an internal target, which I revise. And a starter, of course, is always net asset value. You know, companies has to be worth its net asset value at the very least without allowing for anything else. And there are many companies out there that, you know, this can take 3 to 5 years before the market wakes up to that fact, especially in the, let's call them the tiddlers, you know, the AIM stocks or the smaller companies.
So, like Dart historically, what other excellent companies do you think remain undiscovered at the moment, at the current time?
Gosh, that's a difficult one, isn't it? This is there are a fair few companies out there that I particularly like at the moment. If we want to start, or if I look at one of my favourites at the moment, was a company called Mullins, which was renamed to MPAC. And MPAC had a change of management 2 to 3 years ago when Tony Steeles came in as a CEO. And Tony changed the direction of the company by selling off the tobacco machinery side of what was Mullins, and obviously changed the name to MPAC at that time. Took a substantial amount of money, which has paid down the debt and was sitting on the balance sheet up to this week. They've spent about half of that money this week buying an American packaging company. But they're still sitting with in excess of £10 million. Now, MPAC bought a company very close to me in Yorkshire called Lambert. And Lambert is based in Tadcaster. I was there on Monday and was impressed on just how busy they are. Now, MPAC have moved into the specialist, and they're moving more into AI, which I see as, you know, the artificial intelligence in packaging and machinery for the future is going to be vast. Tony and the team that he's got there are going to take this company, I think, into the big league very soon. They're heavily tipped in the market at the moment. Share price is up another 10% today to sort of 330, 340. I've got a target of £6 for the shares based on the fact that I believe this is going to be a £120 million turnover company within or by the end of 21. I think that profits by that point without any other bolt-on companies could be in excess of £10 million. I'm using a multiple of 12 to give a valuation of 120 million. On that company, which is £6 a share, which is, you know, still double from where it is today, even after the rise this week. Will it get there? Well, much depends on how well Tony and his team do and how they deliver with these new acquisitions. But MPAC really is at the forefront. You know, they redid all the video conferencing last year. So when COVID struck, they were at the forefront and still able to conduct all their business. They're very good at informing investors through webinars and presentations through equity development and various others that of exactly what's going on. And they're building a brand, a very, very good and very strong brand. And I've built my stake up, and I'm still buying there because I think there is a long way for it to go. It's a very exciting company because AI is completely new to me, to us all, and I think it's going to be huge in the future. So that's one of them. you know, the negatives with MPAC was that there was a huge pension, not a huge pension deficit, but a large pension liability. That hopefully should be gone by 2024. But the market cap of the company compared to the pension scheme, it was dwarfed by it. So that's been something that people have been a little bit frightened of. But I think they're in the right sector. I think they've had a fantastic order intake during the early stages of this pandemic. And I think they're benefiting from this move to bring production back to not just the country of origin, but to move things back from China in particular, because of the issues. So this bolt-on company that they've just bought in the United States, and I've not seen what Tony's had to say about it yet, but I can imagine it will fit in. There'll be some cost-saving synergies there. But I really think MPAC is one to watch. I think it's going to be a very, very exciting ride with what is an excellent management team. So we will see. This could be, it really could be huge. It could be as big in terms of growth as exciting as Dark Group Jet 2. And I'm certainly hoping so. So that's my first pick.
And is that your top pick?
Yes, I think it is. I think there is so much there. You know, most of the ones that I'm looking at the moment, they're all going through exciting stages of development. So, but yeah, I do like, there's a lot happening with MPAC at the moment.
And what's your next pick?
Oh, goodness me. Where would I like to go next? let's have a little chat about a company called Tandem Group. I'm not sure whether you know about Tandem Group, which
bicycles, isn't it?
Well, bicycles is one particular division which, yes, it's been very strong this year. I looked at the numbers out from Halfords third quarter figures yesterday, which showed that the trend for bicycle sales was even stronger in August than it had been in previous months. What's happening at Tandem? Okay, Tandem is again a seriously undervalued company. The major change there that in January this year, several shareholders bought the stake that was held by Jupiter, which was between 10% and 12%, I believe, of the shares. We managed to buy that stake, split it up between certain shareholders. And the major shareholder also took another 2%, I believe. And several meetings were then held with the board of directors. There were a few changes taking place there. And the shareholders put their position to the board. The board, to be fair, listened. Got a little bit stretched around the time of the annual general meeting. But I think the major change is that the board are now shareholder friendly. And we have a site visit due and a presentation for the first half results this month. So that's the material change there. I think the board are finally realizing that actually there's a wealth of talent there in the shareholder base. The shares have reacted and moved up from about £1.50 to, I think they're about £3.50 today. They've been as high as £4. They're still trading at around net asset value. There's a substantial amount of cash within the company, probably. And we'll find this out in September, probably 5 million. It's a tiddler, 15, 16 million pound market cap, sales of 40 million. I think it's going places. I think it's got massive potential. It's had a couple of bolt-ons over the last 4 or 5 years where it bought a company that supplies a lot of outdoor camping and gazebos and things that people have really wanted this year, especially when the weather's been good. So I think there's a lot of potential there for additional bolt-ons. The company is only trading now at its net asset value. I think it could become a dividend stock because shareholders have asked the board if they could look at, have a look at the amount of that's being paid to shareholders. I think this year we may make 50 to 60p per share. Well, if it makes 50 to 60p per share, it has to be worth between £5 and £6. In my opinion, we're at 350 now. And I think the board should be looking at paying at least a third of that out to shareholders. So that's the material change there. The change in direction has been the new board, new chief executive, new chairman. And I believe that they are now shareholder friendly, whereas before there's been a them and us relationship. So that's very, very, that's one to watch anyway.
Brilliant. Okay. And I know you were going to talk about Hargreaves Services. Can we get your views on that? Have I taken you out of order?
No, not at all. Not at all. Hargreaves Services. Yes. Again, Hargreaves did an awful lot of business based in the north, which is why it first came to my attention. Hargreaves historically were coal distributors, coal miners, coal importers. They produced smokeless fuels. And then they've moved into biomass, which is questionable. Is, you know, where biomass and how it's produced and whatever. But the company's gone through a complete change because 2021 sees the end of the traditional coal market in the UK. It will be banned to be burnt. You're not allowed to burn it even on a domestic level. So that will go. So what have Hargreaves done? How have Hargreaves reinvented themselves? What have they done? Turnover, obviously, substantially down from that. They're no longer bringing in any or very little thermal coal for British Steel. But what they did do is, I mean, a huge amount of their business was supplying Drax. Drax, which is another company that I'm interested in. We're not really going to talk about it today, but Drax produces about 8 or 9% of the UK energy needs from a single site near Selby up here in Yorkshire. And it was the biggest coal power station in Europe. That now is down to two coal-fired units. The other four burn biomass because obviously the issues around carbon and carbon capture. So Hargreaves lost that contract. They were moving coal from the local deep mines here into Drax. They're now doing the working with Stobarts, and they're still doing the biomass, which is going in there. However, Hargreaves have reinvented itself, and what they've been left with after the demise of UK Coal and various other companies is a massive land bank of land, both in Scotland and in the UK. The Harwood Capital have taken a reasonable size stake in Hargreaves, and an announcement this week that the Hargreaves have taken a new non-executive director who is the son of the founder of Harwood Capital. Harwood are in there, I believe, to try and get some value from Hargreaves. Their share price was, when I made my notes, about £2.15. The company's got a net asset value in excess of £4. And some of the land bank is still in the books at historic value. So there could be some substantial uplifts in value there. We've got some extra dividends to come in from an overseas development, which start in 2021, which should take the dividend to just short of 20p a share. So that's nearly 10% yield on where we are now, which obviously is very, very high. and that's forecast to remain for a number of years. I think Hargreaves are due a substantial re-rating based on the release of the land bank. And I don't know what it's like where you boys and girls are throughout the country, but in this part of the world, houses have never sold as quickly or gone up as quickly as they have for the over the last 3 to 6 months. Whether this is a blip, whether this is a long-term change, I'm not quite sure. But land values are increasing, reflected by the end of the chain, obviously the house price. So I think there's some upgrades to come from Hargreaves. I think it's a good management team, and I think the involvement of Harwood and having a non-executive director who's only, you know, a young chap at 30 years old, I think he'll bring some good fresh ideas to them. So I it's one that people really need to do some deep investigating in and have a good look at it, but it's one I really do like.
Do you have a target price for it?
I do. My target price is £4, which would take it back to net asset value. So, you know, that's a doubling from where it is, or very close to it. I think about 212, 215. I looked at it this morning, and it was pretty flat. I looked at the book. The book suggests to me that the overhang of stock that's been there, that's been holding this down, with a couple of sellers, seems to be disappearing, and I think it's due for a re-rating at the end of this year. You know, I'm still a bit of a traditional one. I still use a stockbroker. I've used Redmayne Bentley for many, many years, and I can often buy within the prices quoted on the automatic screen. So whilst I pay a little bit more for my dealing, I can often get within the prices that are quoted on the trader screens. But yeah, so Hargreaves is definitely one for people to have a little look at.
Great. And I think you've got a couple more that you are hopefully going to get time to talk about.
I've got three more here that I'm just going to briefly touch on. One is a company called LPA. Which again, I think has gone up slightly today. LPA has been hit very hard. The share price was about £2. It's down to about 70 to 75p now. They're into connectors and LED lighting for trains. Now, obviously, they were doing a huge amount with the government and the rail companies on, or will be on Crossrail, but HS2 that's to come. But the modernization of the fleet of rolling stock within the UK. And all this has stopped because of COVID. So they were really, you know, they were hit hard and made a small loss. But it's a good, strong company. Again, it's well asset backed. They've got a division again in the north here, which is how I picked them up. So LED lighting, electrical connectors, and that once, I think that's, there's a chance that could recover over the next 18 months back to where it was. So that's LPA. The next one on my list is this a company called Robinson, which is a packaging company, ticker code of RBN. Robinson is a packaging company and has had a very busy period up to now this year because of the demand for supermarket goods and with people being at home, etc. The changes at Robinson have been a new CEO she came in there, and she's just starting to move things round a little bit. There's a bit of a property play there. There's quite a bit of excess property, which is probably worth nearly half the market cap. It's been sold several times, and then every time we get there, it's sort of fallen foul because of either the regulations and this time COVID. But that's probably due to go through at the end of or the beginning of 2021. The company will either invest the money or pay a special dividend back to us. But that's one I like. Shares are up a huge amount this year, from 50p to about 130, I think, now. I still think there's some more upside in that good dividend payer, profitable, no debt, which, you know, none of these companies have got any debt. So I quite like that one. One that's out of my sector completely because it's not local to me is a company called Manx Financial, which is a bank based on the Isle of Man. Very, very profitable. Trades at less than half its net asset value. And I've been looking for a catalyst at what's due to change there. And I believe that now the historic losses have been written off the balance sheet, then I believe that Manx are going to be in a position to pay a dividend to shareholders, probably by script rather than cash. And I think that probably will be announced at the end of this year, at the end of 2021. I think that could be the catalyst for a serious re-rating in the value of Manx Financial, which is trading at 7 or 7.5p. It's Jim Mellon's got a big stake in the company, but it's clean now. It's profitable. It's in a great sector. It's not got much subprime, and I just think it's hitting the niche where some of the bigger banks within the UK and within that sector are leaving some big gaps. And yeah, I think that's another one for people to have a little look at and do some research on. So that's Manx Financial.
Tremendous. And do you ever get it wrong?
Oh gosh, yes. I could sit here and say no, of course we do. I don't know any investor out there that could say that they don't. Yes, we do. The thing about getting something wrong is that you've got. I try and learn from where and how those mistakes were made, and sometimes it can be. It's usually caused by jumping in without doing my due diligence or doing enough background checks on a company. But I have been caught. I've been caught several times. And I guess you should never really be in a position with your stake in any company that if you lose it, that can do material damage to your portfolio. You've just got to make sure that the winners outnumber the losers, and analyze where you went wrong and why you went wrong. And it is difficult if you look in the market. You know, if you look at Luke Johnson and his company that we spoke about the other day, in mainly based in London. You know, how can companies that are quoted PLCs go so badly wrong that the auditors fail to pick up things? But you know, things go wrong. Fraud happens within these companies, and no shareholder can, if the management don't know what's going on, then the shareholders have got no chance, have we really at all?
Can you give us an example of one you got wrong, say, and what you learned from that?
Well, the company that was originally called Bargain Booze that went into Conveniality. It rapidly expanded and bought several divisions, such as Clark's, and this was the company that it was close being a drinks and a food distributor based in the north. We were aware of it, and they operated on a franchise model. They've got shops, some of them down in the south, but a huge number in the north. I like the business model. It all looked, everything looked right. And then it made a couple of announcements to the market, which were red flags, really. And I thought perhaps the market had overreacted. And I jumped in on this particular one, getting, as I say, without doing my due diligence, and invested, I don't know, £100,000 or whatever the figure was. It was a lot of money at the time. You know, it was busted. It had gone. You know, it had failed to disclose that it owed HMRC £30 million. I'm not sure how you missed that, but they did. And it literally, it went. And then, of course, once the liquidators are involved, then you get very little for it. It sells off, you know, a division that it paid 100 million for or 80 million for, sells off for a couple of million quid just to put some money in, back into it. So the chances of getting anything back then for shareholders is very, very slim. It's usually investing without doing your due diligence. Nobody would take a tip from anybody on a bulletin board or from a magazine or wherever. And, you know, there have been tip sheets out there that it's been proven over a period of time, occasionally can be pushing stocks or whatever. And you can't take everything at face value. What we've discussed today and what other people discuss, people have got to go away and assess the situation, have a look at it, and look at the numbers, look at the prospects for that particular company, and be comfortable with the risk that they're taking, because it's a tough world out there, and they're for, you know, for every great company, there will be an equally bad one or an equally bad investment. But yeah, each case has got to be decided upon merit.
And finally, very quickly, why do you post on bulletin boards, and what are the pros and cons of doing that?
Well, they weren't there initially when we started, but I think they're a fabulous source of information, and questions can be asked. And somebody could be particularly knowledgeable or particularly close to that company that could answer a specific question. Just as I was particularly knowledgeable about Dark Group, because it was one that I studied and I really kept across, so I knew about the fleet and how many aircraft were flying, whatever. So people would often come to me for that information, which I could share. I think ultimately it's a platform for sharing information, and that's something that historically we didn't have until the internet revolution has brought this, and you know what we're doing today, the discussions now and the webinars and the structure, it's completely new, but it's the sharing of information. And before, gathering information was quite difficult, because you'd only get it really from traditional hard print, through newspapers, or via your stockbroker or whatever. Well, bulletin boards, you know, once you take the chaff off there and take a few of the people who are there for whatever reasons, and I know who I listen to, and people, perhaps some people out there, are not interested in what I've got to say, but I find it a very interesting way of gathering information about a company and enabling you, as part of your due diligence, and I use the word part key bits, because just because somebody tells you it doesn't mean it's true, but you can then go and check that information out. I think they're good fun. It's just like going down to the pub, isn't it? At the end of the day, you can have a chat there, and especially for the last 6 months when nobody's been allowed out.
Absolutely.
So it's good fun.
Absolutely. Well, I could carry on talking to you for hours, but we've got loads of questions that have come in. So I think that I better go straight over to questions. So the first question from Bill Hall, given your success at Dart and knowledge of the changing holiday market, have you ever run your slide rule over On the Beach, a Manchester-based company whose low-cost internet-based holiday model aims to challenge the traditional big tour operators such as Thomas Cook and TUI?
I know a little bit about the company, but I'm not sure that there's enough there to challenge people like Jet2. The big advantage of the Jet2 business model is it's fully vertically integrated. And Philip Meeson, when he set it up, was very keen that he controlled all aspects of that process, from booking the flight, the transfer, the hotel, the reps, even checking your bags in at the hotel for the people who want to go on a package holiday before they come back. And it used to drive Philip mad that he was let down frequently by companies operating buses or companies operating airports, by they couldn't find anybody to get the luggage off a plane, and so it would be delayed, or a tractor driver to push the aircraft off a stand. And he took the whole thing in-house, so he controls the whole process. And the bit that worries me about on the beach is that they are relying on others for certain aspects of that. So whilst they're selling something, they're relying on a third party for their flights and bits and pieces at the other end. And that's the USP about Jet2 Holidays. And Jet2 Holidays will, without any doubt, be number one in the market when all this pandemic and everything's over, within 18 months, without any doubt, because, you know, the way that they've handled themselves through this problem is second to none. They're up there on the leaderboard with all the rewards. They've handed the money back very quickly. They've flown empty aircraft out to repatriate people. They're just a fantastic organization, and you know, will probably help the demise of Thomas Cook. But so yeah, to answer the question, on the beach is not one that I really know a lot about. But had a choice of the two, you know, I look at Wizz Air. I mean, that's another one. I you know, Wizz Air took completely different business model, and I look at it, and you know, I quite like it. It's not something that I don't know. They're opening a base up here in the north in Doncaster and filling in some gaps that have been left by EasyJet. The aviation industry, though, is going to be a tough ride for them for the next, because nobody really knows when this is going to finish. And I'm sure somebody told me today that Crystal have cancelled all their chalet holidays for skiing for this winter. And that's in September, and that's through to April. So this thing could run into the early part of summer 21. So we don't know. So I'm sorry I can't help you, Bill, on that one.
We've had two questions, one from Michael Robertson and another from Mark Atkinson, asking how many stocks do you hold in your portfolio, and is the number a consideration?
Yes, it is. I've got... I never have more than 12. I tend to go for 10 in my income portfolio, which I run some ISAs for family members who are retired and they're looking for sort of income. So 10 to 12 in there, and I run a maximum of about 15 in my trading ISA portfolios, my SIPs. I struggle really to do the research and the due diligence on more than that. An ideal number would probably be 10 to 12. And to be fair, I think that's probably enough. I think once you start getting into the 20s and 30s, it really is very difficult to maintain. So 10 to 15, I think my view is plenty.
Fabulous, thank you. And Paul Hawkins asks, fascinating, thanks for sharing your thoughts. What metrics, other than NAV, do you use as the cornerstone of your research? So, for example, MPAC would fail a lot of quality checks, for example, operating margin.
I guess a lot of that depends on the interpretation. But if you're going through a period of transition with any company, I think it's very difficult to look at a single metric or valuation method, and it's like cash flow and free cash flow and all these various tools that people use. And you know, you've got the excellent Stockpedia that've got some fantastic things on. I don't think you can get too hung up on one or two specific methods, because generally there are reasons, and I think if you speak to the company and you get a better understanding. And again, this happened with When Jet2, when Dark Group changed from, in effect, having no debt, and they announced the order to buy, I think it was 30 at the time, new 737-800 airplanes, they took on quite a lot of debt. Now, that was a massive change and a red flag for quite a few people. Instead of what Philip Meeson was very good, the company were very good at buying older aircraft, reworking them. These were older aircraft that had done very few cycles, but they could get another 10 years out of these and carry no debt. The business was financed by customer deposits. And then they changed it. And quite a few people either came out of Jet2 or Dart because of that change of direction. And yes, it, on some metrics, that would have been a flag that immediately they've taken on, and nobody knew what they paid for these aircraft, but I don't know, probably 50-60 million. So, you know, £1.8 billion worth of debt for a company that had historically just been in net cash may have frightened people away. But no, I don't get too hung up on a specific. I try and look at the whole picture. I thought he was going to mention the pension issue with them, because, you know, with a £400 million pension pot and a company that was only worth, when I started investing in them, 20 million, that was always the red flag there. But that now seems to have almost disappeared, and the pension issue should be clear by 2024. So I look at a range of them. I wouldn't let any particular one stop me investing in a company.
Thank you. And we've got two questions on Hargreaves. One is, how much of the £4 NAV is the land bank? And the second part is there any effect of COVID, good or bad, on Hargreaves?
The second bit, I'm not sure. The effect of COVID, quite a few companies obviously are releasing information, but it's a very fluid situation. And as everybody's aware, there's not everybody's back in the office. Not everybody's back working yet. I know a lot of my son-in-law-to-be is a project manager, and is working from home. I will be working from home for a year. Very few site visits, so there's very little visits that they can do. They're working from home because the office will not take the capacity of all those people. The land element is a large proportion of the net asset value, which is good news, because the legacy coal industry and the unwinding of that, and to be fair, the foray into some of the land, the earth moving division that they bought, which wasn't particularly successful. I know they've got some HS2 work coming up, but I think Hargreaves is a play, to be fair, on land, and I think that is one way of playing that market. I think that's what's going to be the catalyst for the uplift in the share price.
So Matthew Appleyard says, so they sold the land. How do they replace the coal income stream that was so profitable?
Well, it was profitable initially. And of course that's now gone. There's nothing they can do about that. But they obviously bought the earthworks company. I guess once they get their hands on some cash, they're into some form of energy and it's not from a recycling system. I think that's what the German operation is. But I guess they'll probably look at they might go on the acquisition trail and look at bolt-on companies. But you know, the land bank is huge. There's years worth of land there to be redeveloped and sold off. And a lot of it are brownfield sites, which the government are very keen on seeing coming back into use. And an awful lot have gone in producing sheds, which are used now for the tick up in sort of home deliveries and internet type shopping. So, and obviously some residential. So, I think there's a question mark over the long term future, but I think you will see the management look at buying alternative revenue sources, or I hope they do anyway.
Thank you. And final question from Mark Atkinson, who asks, how easy do you find it obtaining access to management, so getting site visits, and can you provide any advice?
I've never struggled. I've got a fantastic relationship with a lot of, probably the most difficult, the bank in the Isle of Man, but that I guess is because of where they are. But my relationship at Jet 2, at Dart, the directors are always willing to correspond. Obviously, they have to choose the words very carefully because they can't be in a position to give information to an individual shareholder that's not in the general market. So you can't. You couldn't go and ask a specific question and ask, you know, where they think profit figures are going to be on a certain year. But if they are just general inquiries, background information, if I need to know anything about hedging, which is an area that I really struggle with Jet 2 and the airline industry, the fuel hedges and things, often. You know, Gary Brown, at the chief financial officer at Jet 2, would run me through that and explain that to me, so I can make a judgment call on that. So, no, I tend to find that most are willing. And at the end of the day, remember that the non-execs are there primarily to support us, the shareholders. So, if you can't get to the, you know, to the chairman or the CEO, then start with the non-exec directors and go to them and see what you can wheedle out of them.
Thank you. I'm afraid that's all we've got time for. But where can people find you?
Through you, Tamsin, of course. I am on ADVFN and I am on Twitter. As Castleford Tiger, which is nice and simple, but yeah, by all means, if somebody sends me a message through there, then I'll do my best to respond and get back to them with an email address or a contact details.
Thank you very much. If you want an email notification of webinars or events PI World are organising, go to the right-hand side of the homepage at piworld.co.uk. There are two boxes. At the top, sign up for a notification of a new video as it's published, and underneath, sign up for events. Different lists, no spam. And please do tell your investing friends about PI World and write comments or like our videos on Twitter, bulletin boards and YouTube. We also produce all videos as a podcast, so do write reviews for the podcast on iTunes. We'd like to go on providing these free webinars, and getting really good speakers like Andrew relies on you and the audience numbers we attract. If you have ideas of speakers, do email or message me. You'll find me through the contact page at piworld.co.uk, or follow me on Twitter at TamsinPIWorld. Many thanks to Andrew, and thank you all for joining us, and stay well. PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.